Governor J.B. Pritzker says he wants to end the HIV epidemic in Illinois by 2030. Today, what needs to be done to achieve that goal? Plus, Nafisa Thompson-Spires is the author behind the book Heads of the Colored People. She joins us to talk about her short story collection that showcases black life in a way not often written about.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Coming up later this hour, we'll revisit an interview with Nafisa Thompson-Spires, a writer and former University of Illinois professor whose debut story collection, Heads of the Colored People, was longlisted for the 2018 National Book Award. But first, nearly 40,000 Illinoisans are living with HIV. The good news, though, is that the number of people getting HIV is decreasing. From 2006 to 2017, new HIV transmissions decreased by 35%. Now, state public health officials and organizations believe we can actually eliminate the HIV epidemic in Illinois altogether. Governor Pritzker announced a plan in May called Getting to Zero Illinois. The goal? To end the HIV epidemic in our state by 2030. Nyla Boodoo spoke with some of the people behind this statewide effort back when the plan was first announced. Dr. Ngozi Ezike is the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. John Peller is president and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. And Candy Krause is the director of Teen and Adult Services at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District.
Dr. Ezike, I wonder if you can just start by laying out what the HIV epidemic in Illinois looks like right now in 2019.
Using 2017 data, we have approximately 40,000 people who are living with HIV in Illinois. The majority of those people are in the city of Chicago, about 24,000 of the 40,000. That's where the majority of people live. But Cook County is our hardest hit county in the state of Illinois.
And so the goal is to reduce HIV in Illinois to what's called functional zero, right? Which means no new HIV transmissions, no one with HIV who isn't getting treatment. This seems very ambitious, but I wonder why you think this is within reach, Dr. Ezike.
Well, just for a little bit of clarification, when we say getting to zero, the zero means functional zero. So it means that the number of new cases are so low, and for our purposes, the number is 100 cases per year, that number is so low that it would not be enough to sustain the epidemic. So functional zero, that's what we're trying to get to. With this amazing tool in our toolbox, PrEP, we think that's the extra tool in our toolbox that can really help us get there. With getting to zero, this plan was put together with years of planning, talking to community stakeholders, talking to people living with HIV, talking to providers. So in assembling all the data of what maybe are some of the barriers and why we were not there, I think all those things were put together in this plan, and now it looks like we can get there in the next 10 years.
And so when we think about those barriers, I wonder, John, if you could help us out by just explaining what PrEP is for people who aren't familiar.
PrEP is a HIV medication, and it's taken daily. When it's taken consistently and correctly, it's almost 100% effective at preventing HIV. What's really incredible is that we now have a pill that folks can take if they're vulnerable to HIV that's almost completely effective at preventing HIV, which is revolutionary. As Dr. Ezike said, that's really the game changer, or one of the game changers now. The challenge, of course, is making sure that individuals most vulnerable to HIV are taking PrEP and know about it. And those individuals who are most vulnerable are young, Black and Latinx, gay and bisexual men, transgender women of color, and African-American cisgender women.
Candy, when we're thinking about those barriers that Dr. Ezike was describing to us, what do you see as current barriers to access to PrEP?
I think the biggest barrier that we're seeing right now is that people don't have the information and aren't educated on the efficacy of PrEP. I mean, I think we're still talking to people in Champaign County who have never heard of it. Increasing people's understanding and getting information out in our community, this is a very effective tool. It's available, and it may be a tool that people in our community can use. And I think one of the things that we have benefit of is that insurance and Medicaid and drug prescription plans are very helpful in helping people pay for the medication. We're setting up networks all over the state to make sure that people can access the testing required and see the provider that they need to do and get the prescriptions paid for. So I think access-wise, we've done a good job. I think we need to do a better job of letting people know that it's available.
And when we think about that, Dr. Ezike, there's so many factors involved to accomplish this, right? And on the website with your plan, we noticed there the idea of training the public health workforce to adapt was right at the top. Why do you think that's such an important part of this equation?
Well, definitely we want people who are going to be interacting with the people who would benefit from this to have many different characteristics. We want them to be armed with the right information. We want them to be culturally competent, to be able to connect with the people that they're trying to reach. We want to make sure that they have access to the right resources that they need to be connected with. We want people to be sensitive to other things that might be also very critical, like, as John mentioned, some of the social determinants of health. There might be other issues that are creating a barrier, if there's housing issues, education issues. So we just want to make sure that everyone is outfitted with all the skills and tools that they need to be most effective in their roles.
That's Dr. Ngozi Ezike, who's the director of Illinois Department of Public Health. We've also been speaking to Candy Krause from Champaign-Urbana's Public Health District and John Peller, who's the president and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. John, as we think about there's the public health part of this, and then there's different roles that different community organizations, certainly nonprofits such as the AIDS Foundation of Chicago, will play in this. When you think about the community role of spreading the word about PrEP, where do you see your role?
I think the AIDS Foundation of Chicago's role is quite unique because we do a lot of advocacy work in Springfield. And so, for example, right now we're working on legislation that would allow minors who are 12 and over to access PrEP without parental consent. Sometimes youth, particularly if they're LGBT, often aren't comfortable talking to their parents about the fact that they're gay. And so talking to a trusted provider to get access to PrEP could really make the difference in the high HIV rates we're seeing among youth in particular. I think community-based organizations have a really critical role because we can engage foundations and corporations in providing additional financial resources to the fight against HIV. We can bring together sectors that are currently not at the table who should be and who really need to be providing additional culturally competent resources. And so, for example, we want to get the mental health and substance use treatment sectors to think about the role that they have in getting to zero by providing culturally competent services to people who are vulnerable to HIV or living with HIV.
Dr. Ezike, I wonder if we've talked about there's 40,000, about 40,000 Illinoisans who are living with HIV. That's according to 2017 data. What are we thinking about in terms of a population that may have HIV and not be aware of it?
Yeah, that's a very important point, and that is why testing is such an important part of this getting to zero plan. If people are not testing, if the availability of testing is not where it should be, you just have a growing number of people who may have been infected and don't even know and won't even be thinking about availing themselves of getting treatment. So again, the numbers of people who actually have HIV, of course, is a significant percentage higher than what we know. And so we really have to never take our foot off the gas in terms of talking about testing so that we can get real numbers and be closer to actually treating people and intervening in people who actually need our help.
If I can add to that, I think it's so important that healthcare providers routinely test people for HIV, which is not something that we see happening enough. An HIV test should really be like a test for diabetes or a test for really any kind of health condition. And part of the importance of that is that we see about a quarter of people who are newly diagnosed with HIV also being diagnosed with AIDS at the same time. And that shows that they've been living with HIV for a very long time, haven't had access to treatment because they haven't known that they're HIV positive, and they're pretty sick. And it's really evidence that the system is not working for many people with HIV. So routine testing.
Candy, can you just explain what living with HIV looks like today in 2019?
Well, I can give it a shot. I think that the environment has changed so dramatically over the last 30 years that the person living with HIV today is healthy and successful and has a great deal of ability to control their own health outcomes, and that we're treating HIV as a chronic illness now as opposed to something that's seen as fatal. And I think that the biggest factor in that is we have really good treatment. We have more providers that are versed in treating HIV disease. And so the days of, you know, traveling hours and hours to see a specialist are gone. And so and the medications are certainly more tolerable for most. And so I think the issues come in for people who don't have access to healthcare or have other life situations that are more pressing than their HIV disease, as John alluded to. So I think that those are the barriers that we face today in the fight against HIV.
Dr. Ezeke, I can't help but think about a conversation we had recently about the growth of syphilis in rural areas and how much that was because of a stigma of not going to doctors, not able to talk to people about this. And I wonder how you want the general public to be thinking about the stigma around HIV and AIDS, especially people who maybe think they're not personally affected by this or who aren't working in public health.
Well, I think John hit this very well. Like, when you see your doctor, nobody thinks twice about getting their blood pressure checked or having their weight checked. And we really need to be the same way when we're screening for sexually transmitted infections and HIV as well. So it should be, you know, for a primary care physician, if you're doing an annual, you know, those should be routine blood tests that go with your regular exam. So that takes some work on the part of the providers to make sure that they're doing this routinely. It also, you want to empower, you know, patients to let go of any stigma related to sexually transmitted infections and even be asking for it if the doctor doesn't mention it. If they say, oh, I'm getting my blood test, you know, if the patient could be empowered to say, and am I getting my HIV and syphilis test? Those would be appropriate conversations for a patient to have, you know, with their healthcare provider.
John, regardless of sexual orientation or life circumstance, what do you want? How do you want people to be thinking about this as we think about this goal of getting Illinois to zero by 2030?
So I think it's very important for folks to know that there's some really powerful science now that shows that HIV treatment is incredibly important for individuals who are living with HIV to maintain their health, and folks living with HIV who are treated early and continuously can essentially live a near normal lifespan, which is amazing news. There's also an incredible public health benefit to HIV treatment. And when folks are treated and the level of HIV in their body is not detectable, the science tells us that they cannot transmit HIV sexually. We call that undetectable equals untransmittable, or U equals U is the slogan we like to use. And it's, I think, really important for people living with HIV to know that they really can't transmit HIV to their partners if they're on treatment. And we've heard from people living with HIV that when they find out that news, they just feel so liberated. They feel like this incredibly stigmatizing fact that they've been living with, a fear of transmitting HIV to someone else, has been taken off their backs, and they can have a relationship. You know, not to say that they shouldn't use condoms and shouldn't take precautions, but this is an incredible news and really gives us a powerful tool to end the HIV epidemic.
Candy, is there anything else you wanted to add to this as well?
You know, in thinking about this, I'm just so excited that we're living in a time where we can actually talk about the end of HIV/AIDS in our state and in our communities, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it seemed insurmountable that we would ever, you know, our goals were just to slow the transmission rates down. And now we're in the last 6 years, we've seen reversals in transmission rates, and they're going down. And it's what I hope that people in the community hear from this is that there's hope. We actually have the science behind us, and to actually get to functional zero by 2030, and that we need to make sure that we're bringing all of our community along. But, you know, those are the challenges for us in public health and for our partners to address. But I believe we're going to get there.
You were listening to Nyla Boodoo speaking back in May with Candy Krause, Director of Teen and Adult Services at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. She also spoke with Dr. Ngozi Ezike, the Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, and John Peller, President and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. Coming up after the break, writer Nafisa Thompson-Spires talks about her award-winning debut story collection, Heads of the Colored People. Stay tuned, you're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st, I'm Brian Moline. Nafisa Thompson-Spires' debut short story collection, Heads of the Colored People, chronicles the modern lives of middle-class African Americans. The collection was a 2019 Penn Open Book Award winner and was longlisted for the 2018 National Book Award and the Aspen Words Literary Prize. It was also a finalist for the Kirkus Prize and the LA Times Book Prize in Short Fiction. Nafisa was an assistant professor of English and taught creative writing at the University of Illinois. She relocated this fall to Cornell University, where she joined the faculty. But before she moved away from Illinois, Nafisa sat down with Nyla Boodoo in July to talk about the book. We thought this week would be a good time to revisit that conversation, since Nafisa will be speaking Wednesday evening at the Illini Union in Urbana as part of the Union Bookstore's One Campus, One Book reading program. Nyla started by asking Nafisa about the reception to her debut story collection a year after its release.
So it's been a year since this came out, and I wonder, you've been everywhere, so I should say congratulations also as well on the awards, and I know it's just out in paperback in the UK as well. What's it been like to have this debut short story novel that's essentially been about what you've said? I know you've called this a book about weird black people. What has it been like to have such an incredible reception to it?
It's been wonderful. I honestly couldn't have anticipated how nice things have gone. I'd have to thank God for a lot of these things happening. I mean, they're kind of prayers and dreams come true. So I know that other debuts don't always get as much attention, don't always get seen at all. And especially as a short story collection specifically, there's this perception that stories don't sell. And I've been hoping that people will stop saying that, because we've had a really great year for short stories, not just mine, but Jamel Brinkley's collection, Nana Kwame's collection. Alexia Arthur's, just Black short story collections alone have done really great. So it's been nice to not only have one that was successful, but to see so many other people have successful runs.
And I know, and probably it's a difficult question to ask as a writer. You don't write for what the result will be, for how many people will read it. But what is it like to have that?
It's interesting because I don't write for a specific audience necessarily. And when I do, it's usually myself or people who seem to be similar to me. So I set out to write stories that I just wanted to tell, that I was interested in reading or wished that I had been able to read. And finding that so many different kinds of people have seen themselves in them has been overwhelming. The collection's not only done well in the UK, but South Africa specifically. And I'm going to the Edinburgh Book Fest actually next month. I'm really excited about doing that. And it's also getting translated into Italian right now. So the fact that so many different kinds of people, Black or not, have found that they can see themselves in weird Black characters.
And not American
exactly.
as well, right?
Not Black Americans specifically, but Black South Africans and Black British people are saying that they really love the book. So I never could have imagined that that would happen.
And so I think from the title, Heads of the Colored People, it might seem like people might think, oh, this is a very serious book that contains a lot of difficult subject matter. And certainly, as a collection of stories, short stories, that is part of this. But there's also really light stories and very funny moments. And I wonder how you would describe this collection to people.
I like to describe it as a very satirical, sort of darkly humored collection that looks at middle class Black life from a variety of perspectives. Most of the stories are funny because humor is sort of my way of disarming people and getting into difficult content more easily. But I wouldn't say that they're easy stories. I think all of them are quite challenging in some way and kind of complex. The bookends, the first story and the last story, both deal with police violence. The first one through a kind of wry, tongue-in-cheek tone, but it's actually very aggressive too. And then the last story is the only one that's just straight realism that has no sort of humor as a way of providing some levity. So most of the stories are funny, but again, they're all going to hit you in some way.
Yeah, that definitely happens. And I wonder, when you think about the heart of a lot of these stories are about identity, whether it's people who aren't considered Black enough or people who are Black and something else, why was that really important to you?
Kimberly Crenshaw's concept of intersectionality was something I wanted to make sure I fully explored and demonstrated. So that idea, which she coined in the 80s, is that people like to think about feminism, for example, without an intersectional lens. So that would mean that we're all just women, right? Women all share the same sort of basic life experience. Crenshaw's intervention is that, no, that's not actually true. If you're Black and a woman, you have a very specific set of experiences that do not overlap with a white woman's experience. So intersectionality is this idea of looking at all of the many identity constructs that are attached to a person, and specifically for Black women, and that would include disability, chronic illness, lots of other things. So I wanted all of my characters to be intersectional, to not only be Black and grappling with their gender, but Black and grappling with some other thing. So for a lot of people, it's class position. Almost all of the characters are middle class or even upper middle class and feel like they are sort of out of place within Black culture, but also they're not white, so they don't have the privileges of whiteness. Many of the characters are dealing with chronic illnesses or disabilities, or they're interacting with other people who have disabilities. And so it was important for me to just give this sort of broad stroke of what it means to be Black today, and to look at aspects of Black identity that I hadn't read about very often.
And when you say that you hadn't read about it very often, I do think there is oftentimes when we're thinking about literature, in particular, if you're African-American or Black literature, not writing about now, but writing about the past and writing about our history. Why was it really important for you for this to be set now and that it's modern?
I love that question because one of the things I was most interested in was exploring contemporary Black life. And it's not a critique of Black literature. We need so much Black history. We need neo-slave narratives. We need slave narratives that are historical. We need all of that because we have to rewrite the ways that history has been framed, and we have to situate ourselves within that history. But I wanted to read things about living Black people and who were dealing with maybe a more nuanced kind of racism that they weren't always sure how to articulate. So it's not necessarily having a cross burned on your lawn or actually seeing a lynching, but we are still seeing police-sanctioned violence, state-sanctioned violence all the time. We're seeing modern-day lynchings. We're seeing voter suppression. We're seeing a lot of the same issues that we often read about in historical Black fiction today. And so revisiting those concepts, but putting them in a contemporary setting, to me felt like a way to write a relevant book.
I'm speaking with Nafisa Thompson Spires. She's the author of Heads of the Colored People. We're talking about her debut, a collection of short stories. And to that point, Nafisa, I was just thinking as you were talking about that, about the trope, I think is maybe the right word, for the angry Black woman. And there's a story in here that was actually my favorite, and it's called Not Today, Marjorie. And I wonder if you would mind, first of all, before we talk about it, would you mind reading a little bit of it to us?
Sure. Not Today, Marjorie. Marjorie was already frazzled when she entered the DMV. She had tried to stick to her acronym all morning. Watch your feelings for a moment. Acknowledge them. Imagine your options. Thoughtfully proceed. Though she had succeeded in avoiding any unseemly confrontations for the past four consecutive days, the ride to the DMV was taxing, the night before tormenting, and she felt her limits approaching. It was one of those afternoons on which, despite her best efforts, she could not see the good, could not practice the options for avoiding conflict that her therapist was making her study, could not replace the word and with the word but, as she had been instructed to do. On a good day, Marjorie was supposed to say, I'm angry and I can still keep my temper in check, instead of, I lost my temper, but I couldn't help it. Instead of, I hate crowds, but I have to go to the DMV, on a good day, Marjorie could say, I hate crowds and I'm still going to keep my wits about me at the DMV. Today, however, was not a good day. Today, Marjorie paused at an Ice Cube song on the radio and felt a shiver of longing for her old lifestyle and her ex-boyfriend, Charles. Once she stepped out of her car, she immediately regretted her choice of a black long-sleeved shirt. She always wore long-sleeved shirts, the sun burning straight through the fabric onto her arms. Today, Marjorie saw the yellow jackets and the wasps, but not the fragrant lavender bushes that lined the front entrance of the DMV. She smelled the icky pollen, but did not notice the vibrancy of the goldenrods in the planters. One side of her hair wouldn't lie flat, and though she had spent hours flat ironing it, the ends of her hair now looked limp, yet the edges looked beady. Today was all butts.
That's Nafisa Thompson Spires reading one of the short stories from her debut collection, Heads of the Colored People. That one's called Not Today, Marjorie. And this unfolds into both, I would say, both comic and tragic results for her in her trip to the DMV. And I wonder, first of all, just there's a lot of keen observation about human behavior in there. And I wonder how much of this is you kind of paying attention to people and analyzing their behavior. Because I think we've all seen people get angry in public and we don't really, oftentimes we don't stop and think about what is making them angry or why they're having a bad day. And this is kind of sort of this unfolding of that.
Yeah. I'm trying to decide if I want to get in trouble today or not, because...
Get in trouble.
Okay, I'm going to get in trouble. I wrote this story about a person I know. I attempted to write a story about a person I know who has a very bad temper, and to try to sort of understand why this person behaves the way that they do. But then I was at an airport, and I was having an argument with someone on my own cell phone, and I was witnessing the person who was in charge of running the counter scream at every single person who came up to her. If someone said, I just missed my flight, can you help me? She would start screaming like, why do you think this is my job? And they're like, because you are wearing the name tag that says it's your job.
Because you're working at an airline counter.
Exactly. Right. But each person who came by left disgruntled, and she seemed to enjoy upsetting them. So I was watching this whole thing really excited, telling the person I was on the cell phone with what was happening. And I end up missing my flight because I was so into what was happening. So I was like, I have to write a story about this. I have to write a story about a person who is working in service in some way and who actually wants to have a bad reaction to something, but then it's withheld from her, who like is going to have the outburst but doesn't get the moment she expects for the outburst. And that's kind of where Marjorie came from.
And there's this great deviousness to Marjorie herself hating the customer service she receives at the DMV when she herself works in, of all places, the bursar's office at a university, which is also, I think, another place that's sort of designed for frustration when you walk into it.
Exactly. Yeah. There's, I think, a common story about universities in general, but also HBCUs in general, that the financial aid office is a source of a lot of stress for people. So I thought that was a good setting for the story.
I wonder how much inspiration you drew from for example, your students here in Champaign-Urbana, how much they inspired you in certain topics as you were writing about this?
That's interesting. I don't know if I think very much about my students when I'm writing in that way. I do think about whether or not I'm following the advice I give to them. I feel like a hypocrite a lot of the time in the process of writing, but I'm not sure if I've looked at a student or a situation with a student and decided I might write a story about that. So the one story I can think of that does sort of come from academia is the one about Randolph, the guy who's very disgruntled at his job at an HBCU where he has to share an office. And I did have to share an office with somebody years ago, and it was terrible. And
did you get into a lot of petty fights about the lights have to be on, the lights have to be off?
So we had two really wonderful office mates at first, and we had no issues. But then one of them left and a new person came in, and that's when the petty fights about the lights started. And this person claimed that it really bothered her to have the lights off, and it turned out that she was lying. And later, when I finally got a new office, I saw her, and she was in the office with the lights off all the time, and she was basically hazing the new person who had come in to try to push him out too. So that's where that story came from.
And so when you think about that, I wonder how much of these stories, as you said, as we started this conversation, how much you found that they really have resonated people with, regardless of what their background is, because lots of people have had problems when they go to the DMV or deal with something bureaucratic. Lots of people have had fights with their coworkers. Like, this is in many ways a snapshot of a lot of the frustrations that people deal with.
Yeah, you could kind of sum up the collection as also being about petty people or passive aggressive people. I think that's accurate.
And so I wanted to ask you about why this happened in short story form. And I understand that part of this was paying homage to James McKeown Smith. Can you tell us a little bit about him and how that came about?
Yeah, James McKeown Smith is a Black abolitionist, doctor, and poet. He was writing during the 19th century about what it would look like for Black people to have the full rights of citizenship on paper, because they didn't. And he was publishing these little literary sketches as fiction in Frederick Douglass's newspapers. Frederick Douglass had a bunch of different newspapers at the time. And he was serializing them, and they eventually became collected into what was called The Heads of the Colored People, Done with a Whitewash Brush, which was basically an anthology of James McKeown Smith's individual sketches. And my husband writes about this. He's a professor at U of I, or was, and was doing a lot of research about Black citizenship and James McKeown Smith and his contemporaneous writers. And I thought, this is interesting. Some of these sketches feel very similar to the things that we're talking about now. So I initially thought I would update the original The Heads of the Colored People. But what happened was that it felt way too limiting to me as a writer. I couldn't write back and forth James McKeown Smith and take all of his words. So I decided instead to just sort of run with the theme of heads more generally. And that meant for me leadership, psychology, phrenology. I'm thinking a bit about racist science. There's a literal head injury in one of the stories. So that's kind of where the title came from and some of the themes in the collection.
Hmm. And so when we think about those themes too, I wonder how much we haven't talked about the first story, which is really interesting because it, as you said, has really, it's a difficult story about police brutality, but the character is a Black nerd, is actually a Black cosplayer. And I'm guessing that you were a nerd, and when I was a nerd, like growing up, I'm guessing we're around the same age. It was not cool to be a nerd in the way that it is now.
Absolutely not. I was definitely a nerd, but absolutely no, it was not cool to be a nerd.
And so I wonder how, I wonder why that was something that you wanted to include in this collection. And that this, that where did, I wonder where that character came from.
I think Riley came from a lot of different places. I think all of the characters in the collection are pretty nerdy. I don't know how to be anything else, and I think my purview is just nerdy, so that perspective is going to come out of me naturally. But Riley specifically, I was interested in Black men I knew who were insistent that they were completely straight, whatever that means, probably that there was some homophobia in their insistence that they were completely straight, but who were very interested in this kind of self-expression with contacts, especially in the late 90s. There were a lot of Black guys I met who were wearing like green contacts and blue contacts and bleaching their hair blonde, but very invested in this idea that they were masculine and straight and nowhere on the queer continuum or spectrum. And they weren't cosplayers, but I think I kind of took those guys and thought about putting them in the context of cosplay. And I'd also been reading a lot about cosplayers who get backlash for cross-dressing or dressing across racial lines. So someone like Riley, who's dressing as a Japanese character, for example, often would get flack at Comic-Con or a place like that for not making the character as accurate racially as it should be. And I mean, Scarlett Johansson's constantly
in the news for this, right? I was going to say, Scarlett Johansson is just in the news for this, right?
So it's the reverse version of that. It's that white people can dress however they want. They can cosplay as any character. Japanese people can too. Anyone in anime culture can, except black people, that they're not allowed to transracially dress. And so I thought this was kind of a ripe situation for a story.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Nafisa Thompson-Spires. She's author of Heads of the Colored People. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moldine. You've been listening to an interview with writer Nafisa Thompson-Spires, author of Heads of the Colored People. She'll be returning to Urbana, where she was once a professor, for a talk Wednesday at the Illini Union. We thought now would be a good time to revisit a conversation she had in July with Nyla Boodoo.
I mean, you were on everything from Late Night with Seth Meyers to the LA Review of Books Festival. And I wonder, do you find that you have to tailor your audiences or your conversation about the book to the audience you're speaking with? Like, I wonder if it's a different conversation when you're describing this book, if it's a black audience or people of color or maybe a primarily white audience?
I don't think that my content changes, but I think my comfort level changes for sure. So I've definitely gone into spaces where I was giving a reading in a city where the audience was all white, and I didn't feel like it was a good idea for me to start with, for example, Belle Lettre, where two black women are fighting about their kids. I just don't feel necessarily like white people should get to laugh at those two black women without earning it. So I will make them listen to a really hard story first, like Heads, where you have to confront that this kid's being shot by the police, or the last story, Wash Clean the Bones, where a mother is exhausted from seeing police brutality. I make them earn it by first kind of giving them difficult content, seeing if they're able to tolerate the other story, and then deciding whether or not I'm going to let them laugh at this other story. So I do tailor that, kind of the readings and the way I perform, based on my mood that day, and also whether I think the audience should get to just laugh at black people or think more deeply about them.
I wonder what's changed, or if your thinking on that has changed as you've been gone around the country doing these readings and encountering different people. I was talking to a friend of mine recently who's also an author about what the year has been like for her with her book. And she was talking about how she was really surprised at the reception that, for example, churches was a really important audience for her and wanted to read her work. And she didn't think about that. And that was very surprising to her. I wonder if you've found things about this being after your book tour and also reaching all of these different audiences. What surprised you about this?
I do think that there's something universal about humor that can kind of get your foot in the door, I've learned. So I think I had an intuitive sense that that was going on, just in writing, again, some difficult subject matter, but through humor. But in person, seeing people who are not my target audience at all and who will then come up to me after readings and say, like, I'm very conservative. I actually have never really read any black literature, but you made me think I should continue to. That's not something you should say to people, but it is something that people have said to me. And then they've listed off the black books that they are then planning to read because they read my book, or they were interested in my book because of hearing me read it. So that's been surprising as an audience thing. Church audiences, I did anticipate being important and made sure that we tried to market the book to some church audiences.
Is it important for you that this book is considered black literature?
Yes. I actually had a say in which editors I could go with. The book sold at auction, so I got to talk to several different editors, and it was important to me to work with somebody who understood how important that was, because it is a black book. I'm a black woman. I wrote the book for other black people. I wrote it for a very specific audience, weird black nerds who probably grew up middle class, and it happened that other people were interested in the book and liked the book. But I do think that maintaining the integrity of your work sometimes means that your intended audience is smaller than the actual audience ends up being.
And then I wonder then, now that you say that, it's always inevitable to ask the question, how much of yourself is in this writing?
The Fatima stories are the most autobiographical. But I'm not the same as Fatima. I think I'm a lot more assertive than Fatima is. She's kind of mealy-mouthed and sad, and I like making fun of her for that, but I'm more assertive than she is.
So she's the character. Do we first meet her in Belle, in the Belle Letters?
Yeah.
Okay. And that, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit. So that's such a, it's an interesting short story because of the construction. And so I wanted to ask you about this too, the structure of them. Because while they're all short stories, they have different narrative structures within them. And this is one that's a series of letters between these two moms going back and forth and getting, it's such a great parody of mom culture, as well as there's a lot of things going on in there.
Yeah, that story came from, so this is the autobiographical part. My mother sent me a care package that had just things that she'd haphazardly thrown in it. And one of the things in it was a letter from the mother of my childhood bully. And my childhood bully was the only other Black girl in my grade for several years. At times we would get like one Black girl, but she would leave. And so we were the two core Black girls at our school. And she just hated me, like on sight, as soon as I came to the school. But her mother sent a letter to my mother saying that I was the bad kid, that nothing bad had ever happened at the school before I came, that her daughter was basically perfect. And my mother thought that this was something she should give me.
I was
going
to say, why did your mom give this to you? Did she know that she was giving it to you?
She knew she was giving it to me. She was like, I thought you would just want to see it. It also included a note from one of my teachers saying that I had very bad social skills. So maybe I was the problem in the real life story. But in the short story version, the fictionalized version, Fatima is being bullied by this girl, Christinia, and their two mothers are fighting via their backpacks, leaving little notes in their backpacks on legal paper.
It escalates.
They escalate pretty badly, yeah. So much of that story is autobiographical.
Did your mom share with you the letter she wrote back? Because I assume she responded.
She definitely responded. My mom is sort of known for her letter writing. She writes very, very long and aggressive letters when she is disgruntled. And they almost always result in her getting something she wants. She's gotten every year free popcorn from Orville Redenbacher.
Why did she write a letter to Orville Redenbacher?
Unpopped popcorn kernels. Too many unpopped popcorn kernels at the bottoms of her microwave popcorn bags. I think she's written them to like some cookie brand and gotten
certainly airlines, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, airlines. After Seth Meyers, when I told her, Mom, I talked about you on Seth Meyers, you might not like it. She watched it and not only told me that she loved it, but that I should wait till I read her new letter to TSA because I'd really have something to talk about then.
So I wonder if you got inspiration from your mother as a writer, it sounds like.
My mother is a writer, so that's the thing. Not just letter writing. I mean, she has 7 books published and she's an academic. So my mother is a writer professionally and she definitely influenced me.
And when you think about your writing process, I saw this on Seth Meyers. You write with a TV on?
I do. I love TV. So I initially, my PhD research was in television. I'm a TV studies person. That's my background. And I like TV as white noise. I like to watch really trashy TV, Paternity Court, 90210, the original 90210. My favorite show used to be Love Connection with Chuck Woolery. I would watch hours of that while writing. And
I got all my grad school. Is the Game Show Channel your favorite TV channel?
It used to be. They switched out all the old stuff and now it's like, it's not good anymore. But
okay.
Yeah. When Chuck Woolery was on the Game Show Network, I did all of my grad school homework to Chuck Woolery.
Wow. And so what did you write? What were you watching when you wrote Heads of the Colored People?
A lot of 90210 for sure. A lot of Paternity Court, some Divorce Court, an occasional Springer and Mari Povich episode.
And when you're thinking about the structure of these, so for example, that letters, when it's letters back and forth, does that, I wonder if that sort of the structure comes from, is inherent within the story? Like this is going to be a conversation where it's just going to be letters? Or do you think, well, I'm going to start with this as letters and then the story comes from the structure?
I think both things happen. Sometimes the structure definitely dictates the content and sometimes the content dictates the structure. For Belle Lettre, it made sense to write this as an epistolary story and to just jump right into that letters form. And specifically because the epistolary form historically has always been known for satire, making fun of morals, making fun of people's behaviors, making fun of middle class values. So it kind of worked with the content for this story. But for Heads of the Colored People, that structure came to me as I was writing it. I didn't know who Riley was. I was trying to figure him out. And I didn't really know what the story was about. And that came through a series of free writes that I just sort of followed and allowed to take me where they did.
The thing about a short story collection is then, while there's some connection between some of the stories, and we see some of the characters and some of the stories. There's threads between them. There's a lot of different characters in this.
There are.
So who didn't end up in here?
There's one Fatima story that didn't end up in here, but I'm backdooring it as my... It's basically the novel I'm writing right now, so we'll still see it. I don't think very much else didn't end up in here. I think I was trying to figure out how I could tell multiple stories about Fatima in a collection without calling it a linked collection, and without making the stories read as a novella, like kind of plopping them in the middle. I think ultimately we did plop them in the middle and make them read sort of as a novella, so I think you get three Fatima stories, different time periods in her life. But they aren't all the things I want to say about her, which is why I'm still talking about her.
I'm speaking with Nafisa Thompson-Spires, and we're talking about Heads of the Colored People. And I've seen you talk about how you've been inspired by writers who have said if there's a gap that you fill it in. And I wonder if it's hard to draw inspiration when you don't see these stories. You know, we've been talking about this is a book, you know, whether it's about, as you said, sort of weird Black people or Black nerds. There's not a lot of that out there in sort of a literary genre.
It's growing. We're getting a lot more of that, thanks to people like Issa Rae, who have really made it cool to be a Black nerd. And I think the generation before me has always been trying to articulate a sense of Black nerdiness, too. They're kind of the writers who inspired me to feel like I had permission to write the kinds of stories I wanted to. So that would be like the post-Soul writers, people like Colson Whitehead and Matt Johnson and Paul Beatty. They were writing, I feel, a kind of nerdiness, even if they didn't call it that, that made me feel seen. And so when I started reading their work, I felt like, oh, I have permission to tell some of these kinds of stories, and that my own voice is important and a unique contribution.
And that said, I was looking at, I don't know if you watch this, you watch a lot of TV, I don't know how much YouTube you watch, but all of these vlogs that are book reviews, have you seen all of the different vlogs that review your book?
I refuse to watch that stuff. But I do Google myself with the 24-hour results on regularly,
oh, right.
And I've seen
them. So then you've
exist.
Seen them. They're, I mean, I saw a couple, and they're super enthusiastic about your book.
That's nice to know.
And so, but you don't pay attention to them.
I can't, because I'm too sensitive. I know that if I hear one negative thing, that's all I will remember. So.
And so that said, as we're talking about the people you've drawn inspiration from, I wonder what you're working on next. You said you're working on a novel about Fatima?
I am working on a novel. It revisits Fatima. She's now in her late 30s. She's dealing with endometriosis as she is in the collection, but it's advanced significantly, and she's dealing with having just had a miscarriage. And the way that she's coping with all of this sort of bodily stress is through cosplay. She gets involved in a Victorianist cosplay group with a lot of white women who are dressing in corsets and thinking about history in problematic ways. And at the same time, she gets invited to this Black group called the Daughters of the African American Revolution, which is very seemingly activist oriented. And she basically has these two different identities sort of pulling her in different directions. And she has to decide what's going to happen with her body and what's going to happen with her self-acceptance.
Speaking of that, I wanted to ask you about a lot of the book, and particularly the first story is about the way people read their bodies, and you write that. This is about the way someone's reading a body. And I wonder if you can explain a little bit more about what you mean by that and what you want people to take away from that.
I think a lot of it is a kind of rearticulation of, or a way of, expanding on what other people have said about double consciousness, this idea that Black people have their own identity that is just theirs, but then there's this additional perception that gets added to you, that's layered onto your body. And to be Black means to live with both of those, an awareness of both of those things at the same time, your own perception of yourself and the way the world perceives you. And when you add the sort of physical part, the bodily part of that, not just the lived experience, but the physicality, I'm interested in what it means to live in a body that's broken, or a body that is disabled or is becoming disabled because of a degenerative disease. And what it means to live in a body that is overweight and people are judging in particular ways. And Black women specifically have had a history of having their bodies misread as hypersexual. Their bodies have been misused and abused in ways that historically I think are important and that the collection's trying to be in conversation with in drawing attention to the concept of flesh, which is something that comes up a lot in Black criticism and theory, and in disability studies more generally.
And it sounds like you're going to continue that in the next novel.
I hope so.
Yeah. Am I allowed to ask when you're going to finish that?
I have no idea. It's been due to my editor for a long time, and I've gotten multiple extensions, so they're going to get it when they get it.
And now you're moving.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we had a chance to talk to you before you left Illinois. Nafisa Thompson-Spires is the author of Heads of the Colored People. Nafisa, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Brian Moldine. That was an interview between Nyla Boodoo and writer Nafisa Thompson-Spires back in July. Nafisa has joined the faculty at Cornell University, but taught previously at the U of I. She's returning next Wednesday for a lecture at the Illini Union in Urbana at 7 p.m. You can find more information at union.illinois.edu. That's it for us today. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Brian Moldine. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.